regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the third episode of the Tech Roundup podcast, which is part of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project's ongoing fourth branch podcast series. Our Tech Roundup podcast features leading policy experts debating the major legal issues surrounding various emerging technology sectors. My name is Adam Thier, and I'm a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. On today's episode, we'll be investigating recent developments on the privacy law front, and more specifically, what's been happening in California, which is shaking up the debate over privacy policy in a major way. Will aggressive laws and ballot measures in California and other states finally push Congress to take action at the federal level? What role should the states play if Congress doesn't act on privacy? And how do developments in Europe play into this debate? Those are just a few of the questions we'll tee up for discussion on today's show. To help us navigate these issues, I'm joined today by two of the leading privacy policy gurus in America. Joe Jerome is an independent privacy consultant who has spent the past year immersed in state and federal debates on consumer privacy legislation. And Ian Adams is vice president of policy at Tech Freedom, a think tank focused on legal issues surrounding the development, proliferation, and use of technologies. Joe Jerome, let me turn to you first. And before getting into the specifics of what is happening in California, I want to ask you to bring our listeners quickly up to speed regarding how we got to this point.
Awesome.
So take a short step back and give us a 30,000-foot view of how privacy policy has progressed, or maybe rather not progressed, at the federal level over the past decade or so, and why we're at today.
Oh, you're limiting me to only a decade?
So as far back as you want to go.
To try and get through the history of privacy in the United States, the story of data privacy in the United States now goes back really 50 years. We had a number of different laws that tried to get at certain little elements of our economy where Congress was concerned about how data could be misused, things like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Video Privacy Protection Act for video records. The reality is the internet supercharged these debates. And about 20 years ago, our Federal Trade Commission saw an opening to basically become the leading privacy enforcer under its unfair and deceptive powers under Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act. So the FTC began monitoring how companies were using data. And basically, the limitations of Section 5 encouraged the FTC to basically promote companies to be transparent. Be clear about what you're doing with information. Get consent sometimes. And that led to what is commonly referred to now as the notice and choice framework and the proliferation of all these privacy policies that absolutely nobody reads. So that's sort of what was happening at the federal level. It was not a very comprehensive solution. You had a lot of privacy advocates and some companies agitate for more laws. And then states would sort of step into the breach where things went wrong. In 2008, the selling of biometric data from a grocery store chain that went bankrupt, that encouraged Illinois to pass a biometric privacy law. The Equifax data breach really triggered a lot of concern about credit reporting agencies and data brokerage behind the scenes, which motivated Vermont to pass a data broker registry. Similarly, you've had these sort of bipartisan efforts every 10 years to see if there can be a federal solution. So the Obama administration worked on a Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights, but you never got any legislative text at the federal level across the finish line. So why are we interested in talking about this today? Well, last year, two big things happened. First, the European Union passed or finally brought into force the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR. This is a really comprehensive, complicated framework, and importantly, it had really strong teeth in terms of the penalties that could be brought down on companies, and it had extraterritorial reach. So that made it suddenly, whether you're an American company, you still had to be aware of this European law, and it really sort of brought back into the limelight that the United States didn't have a federal response to that. A month after the GDPR went into effect, there was a bombshell dropped in California. And Ian, I imagine you can talk about this. When Alistair McTaggart, a real estate developer, began pushing a privacy ballot initiative, and as a last-minute compromise, the California legislature enacted the California Consumer Privacy Act, which brought elements of the GDPR to the United States for the first time. So now you have, on one hand, you've got on the other side of the Atlantic this comprehensive framework that major multinationals have to follow. And on the other side of the coast, you have a state that is really putting into place an onerous framework that companies were going to any company that wants to play at the national level is going to have to pay attention to. Those two things combined made it so that it's in everybody's interest now for Congress to step in and finally sort of put its thumb on the scale.
That's a great opening introduction to the topic there, Joe. And let me turn to you, Ian Adams, and ask you to talk about California. You spent a lot of your time in the California political trenches, and I'm sure now that you're out here in D.C., you get the question, you know, what the heck is happening in California a lot.
I do.
So what the heck is happening in California?
Well, yeah. So when I moved from Illinois to California years and years ago, before ultimately coming out here to Washington, D.C., I was put into a speech therapy class because no one could understand me with my Illinois accent. So I like to
listeners don't have accents.
Well, and that's what I said, but they didn't understand me. So I like to think that I do speak Californian to a certain extent these days. It's been fascinating. As Joe pointed out, what you had was a real uptick in attention around issues of privacy. And in California, because you have a very accessible mechanism for direct democracy, in spite of the fact that the legislature in 2018 had other priorities, you'd had massive fires, you'd had other big issues that were confronting the state, Alistair McTaggart was able to bring this to the fore. And so he had an initiative ready to go and effectively went to the legislature and said, well, would you like to have something to say about this or shall I go to the ballot? And so
he had a little help from Facebook, too.
He did indeed. And so then at the very end of session, last 2 weeks, a bill by Assemblyman Chow, SB 375, made its way quickly through both chambers of the legislature and was ultimately signed by Governor Brown. And as one might expect for a piece of legislation that was shepherded through the entire process in a matter of weeks, it had some issues. And so this last year, we've spent a lot of the legislative session trying to make the CCPA more workable, or at least that is the perspective that I think industry has. Some consumer groups would probably push back on that characterization. And so now what we have is in January of 2020, the CCPA's provisions will go into effect. And then in June, the Attorney General's office, which I'm told this month in October will promulgate regulations to assist with the enforcement of CCPA, will begin enforcing the act. Now, to complicate things further, just a matter of days ago, Alistair McTaggart's group, Californians for Consumer Privacy, they came out with what is going to be another wrinkle in this entire process, CCPA 2.0, called, what is it, CPREA, California. How would you read
that? The California Privacy Rights and Enforcement Act. I'm going to think we should go with CPREA as the acronym.
Yeah, that's right. So right now there is a 30-day window open whereby Californians for Consumer Privacy will hear commentary from various stakeholders about what should be in this latest iteration of privacy legislation or law in California. And then ultimately, it'll be locked in stone. And it will either go to the ballot or not if they collect enough signatures. And business will have a decision to make about whether they get enough in the way of amendments to make it so they are comfortable with that legislation or that initiative. Or they will probably run a countervailing initiative, as we've seen in the past with other highly controversial initiatives. So that's where we're at in California right now. It's nice and muddled.
Well, Joe, let me turn to you for some thoughts on what's happening in California. But when you answer, I want you to take a step back. And for our listeners who are wondering like now, like, is this the best way to do things? Is this normal? Isn't the internet supposed to be this globally interconnected network of networks and we'll set, you know, national or even global policy? And here we have California. Are they driving the debate? Are they making the law of the land?
They absolutely are. It's not ideal, but it's the world we live in. I come from a background as a diehard privacy advocate. And, you know, it's no secret that Congress isn't doing anything right now. Congress has been seriously discussing privacy legislation since Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. There's been talk of proposals behind closed doors, and Congress has been putting out proposals for decades now. And again, as I said up top, nothing is happening. California, because of the uniqueness of that ballot initiative process, was able to get something done really quickly. And also, you know, I'll push back on you a little bit and say that I think California has an important role to play. It's where Silicon Valley is located. California, in its state constitution, has a right to privacy. And really, California has been at the vanguard of a whole host of privacy laws. I said the FTC encouraged companies to be transparent and put out privacy policies. Well, California was the first state, I think, that made a law that required that. When we talk about things like data breach notifications, all of that started with California. I agree that we shouldn't be passing laws in 2 weeks, but I'm not as dismayed as I think you are that California's in the driver's seat here, because they are a huge economy with a pretty sophisticated year-round legislature. And, you know, they have sort of taken the mantle of this right now, and it's frankly up to Congress to get its acting gear if it wants to step in.
Well, if there were a state jurisdiction to do it, I suppose it would make sense that it's California. But, Joe, you hit it on the head when you said this is something that is squarely within the remit of the federal government. This is something where Congress needs to be acting. And what we haven't really seen, just because CCP has not yet gone into force yet, is the effect of having such a powerful and far-reaching state law. I would not be surprised if the day this goes into effect or shortly thereafter, the Chamber of Commerce or some other large group is going to bring a challenge on Commerce Clause grounds saying that other states are being impacted in a way that is impermissible constitutionally.
Absolutely. I mean, for anybody out there that has done deep dives into the Dormant Commerce Clause, there's a whole lot here to get involved with. I mean, also to your point, it's a muddled law to some extent. You know, there'll be challenges to the restrictions and provisions around use of publicly available information. That raises First Amendment issues. Again, it's a law that was a mishmash of some GDPR, some advocates' thinking, and Alistair McTaggart. It's not an ideal way to make law, but it is what we have to do. I also, and we can discuss this, I'd be interested to know whether you think the actual requirements of the law are that onerous. I mean, not talking about CCPA 2.0, but the current law is really just about access to information, some deletion rights, although there's a lot of exceptions to that, and then trying to cabin companies from being able to sell information, which, you know, strikes me as something that is a reasonable ask.
So there are a couple ways of looking at that, right? There's the sort of the philosophical affront that one might have to those sorts of obligations. But just yesterday, we saw that California released its own economic impact statement. And on a 10-year horizon, we're looking at some pretty serious costs. So gross state product, $4.6 billion. Granted, California is absolutely massive. 14,000 jobs over that 10-year window. And
would be lost, this report says.
As a result of
would
that,
be lost.
Correct, would
yeah.
be lost. And then $9.3 billion in output investment income mm-hmm. would be lost as a result
so
of
can
this.
I push back against that? And I'm not an
sure.
economist.
Of course.
So I know that's one strike against me. But I actually think a lot of the costs of the CCPA are things that companies should have been doing to begin with. I will continue to say that I think in the United States we've had at least the tech companies, and frankly even sort of a lot of in the commercial sector, has had a really laissez-faire attitude with respect to what it needs to do when it's collecting, using, selling, sharing, getting rid of personal information. You know, it's easy to sort of bemoan the regulatory costs of these laws, but I think the public, and I think both of you probably will acknowledge that companies do have some obligations to be responsible with data and to have some sort of data governance in place. And we haven't had a whole lot of that. You know, I don't want to bring too much of the GDPR in here, but if you talk to companies about the GDPR, they will complain about it. They will say that there are provisions in that that make absolutely no sense and are impossible to comply with. But you get them talking long enough, they will say things like doing data maps, doing data inventories, thinking about what data they actually collected and how long they were retaining it has been good for them and useful for the business. And I think that there will be parts of that in the CCPA too. It's obviously going to be painful for some industry sectors more than others.
So Ian, before you answer that, I want to have both of you introduce the concept of FIPS and fair information practices in general, and the question of how fair information practices in the internet age should be governed, and if they can be done in other ways. The debates that we've had in the past, Joe, have been over whether or not that can be done in a sort of bottom-up multi-stakeholder fashion through best practices and agency interactions and so on. And I know you and others have pushed back and said, no, that's not good enough. We need something more formal. But let's start with those practices or principles, because I don't think there's much disagreement with what you just said there, Joe. These are pretty good principles or practices. The question really is one of enforcement, right? And it's really like how they're put in the books. I mean, how would you say we best go about dealing with these principles?
So it's a challenge in California just because we don't know exactly how the Attorney General is going to go about promulgating some of the regulations in this space and what enforcement's going to look like. And as we contemplate CCPA 2.0, a lot of that has to do with making more of these practices enforceable with a state agency specifically geared toward the enforcement of data-related violations. I suppose we don't know what it's going to look like in California quite yet. I think that one of the major challenges is that uncertainty and the uncertainty that is presented by a law that, having not gone into effect and yet being so broad in its scope, could, in theory, be enforced in a really very onerous way. So, obviously, for where I come from, a tech freedom multi-stakeholder approach and an informal sort of benchmark is going to be preferable to something that's put into statute.
All right, Joe, tell us why you think that's crazy.
So the question of meaningful enforcement is at the core of all of these privacy laws. You mentioned the FIPS, the Fair Information Practice Principles, which have their origin in the early 70s. They're old principles. They're very general. They're not very specific. And how you actually legislate them is very challenging. And so my interest is enforcement. What is enforcement actually going to look like here? And one of the real challenges with the CCPA is, you know, the Attorney General has already basically said that they're probably going to bring 2 or 3 cases a year. You know, this law is going to cover tens of thousands of businesses, and they're probably going to have the manpower to look at only a handful of bad actors. So we need to figure out what is a better approach. I would encourage folks, California gets so much attention, it takes so much oxygen out of the room, but there was a very vigorous debate this past spring and likely to happen next year in Washington State, where there was an alternative model that was put forward called the Washington Privacy Act. It had, again, some of the components in the CCPA, but it had a different approach to enforcement. It leaned into, I think, a principle that you guys will like, that we refer to as accountability. And so the Washington Privacy Act, rather than basically having all of these really tough controls the way the CCPA is envisioned to do, instead deferred to companies to be doing risk assessments and to basically more holistically consider their data practices. And then those risk assessments could then be reviewed on request or by demand from the state attorney general. That's a different model. I think advocates tend to suggest, well, that's just letting companies we don't trust make their own decisions about how they want to use data. But it is a different model that gets at this question of how companies are thinking about data and how we should be enforcing these larger principles about fair and ethical data use.
So, and I think that is certainly preferable from my perspective. And in California, as we're contemplating having an agency specific to enforcement of these acts, we're looking at the possibility of having proactive audits done, not unlike you might see with insurance departments and insurance companies, whereby the company is then paying to be audited for their compliance with some, what I would argue are, you know, vague or unworkable standards in some cases. And so I suppose, at the end of the day, I see the train coming down the tracks, but I don't know what the accident's going to look like. And I've been on the side of coalition saying that, you know, some new regulation's going to be absolutely disastrous and then have it sort of in effect be a bit of a whimper, not that outcome. But with CCPA, and particularly with CCPA 2.0, as we're seeing potentially with the initiative, I really am frightened for what it might look like.
So what does that look like? Because from my perspective, as a putting on my privacy advocate hat, I actually think January 1st will come. Mm-hmm. Obviously, enforcement doesn't follow for another 6 months. And I think, as before, the internet won't stop. sales across state lines won't stop. Google and Facebook will still be there. A couple companies might have an obnoxious "do not sell my personal information" sure. button on the bottom of their website. But I think the sun will rise again. And then what? I mean, do we really think that?
So let me push back just a little bit, Joe, because hopefully our standard is somewhat higher than "will the internet run the next day." I mean, it would be things like, will we continue to have vibrant competition and diverse choices and a healthy digital ecosystem? And
well, do you think we have that at present?
I think we have a a healthier, more vibrant one than Europe,
okay,
depending on what your metric of success is, right? But I'm trying to be a fair moderator here, so let me get back to asking you guys to engage on this. But I think there's a legitimate question, especially in light of the report from California yesterday about looking at cost-benefit here. And I would absolutely acknowledge cost-benefit for, you know, social values like privacy, safety, and security. Very, very, very difficult. No doubt about that. Hard to monetize these things. But we can think about choice, different options, competition, consumer values. Ian, you know, that would be the concern, I think, that you would probably articulate from a tech freedom perspective, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's something where if held to standards like reasonability when it comes to data collection practices, as the new initiative is contemplating, I think that a lot of these firms aren't even going to know what to do. I think these are going to be the firms least well situated to have relationships with these regulatory entities and are not going to be able to have the legal teams on staff necessary to help them navigate and comply with a lot of these standards. And so what is going to be the knock-on effect of that? Well, it's not, as you say, it's not going to be that a company is shuttering their door, as I think we may have seen in some cases with GDPR, some just simply unable to comply. Oh man, Joe's wrinkling his nose. but it will be consequences that accrete over time, mm-hmm. and that is going to be a loss for California and potentially the rest of the nation in the context of competition, in the context of innovation.
Joe, why do you hate jobs and consumers so much?
Oh. I guess I'm just I raise an eyebrow just because I think the GDPR was used as a scapegoat for a lot of business models and companies that ultimately weren't doing very well anyway. So, the clout, the social scoring network went out of business. Well, it had a lot of underlying problems. There were other examples of video game companies that couldn't appropriately do access and deletion requests, so they went out of business, except for the fact that the games were being played by 12 people. So I understand that is a loss to the world, but it's 12 people at the end of the day. I take your point that we don't actually know what the impact of the CCPA will be, and that's a problem. That's a problem that privacy advocates and people that are pro-privacy need to grapple with. I would like to know, you know, you're talking about firms. Well, which firms in particular? Because what makes the CCPA interesting in the United States is it is a comprehensive privacy law. In the United States, we tend to do this sectoral approach. We'll get some healthcare providers, we'll get financial institutions, obviously, we get schools, but we don't get everybody. And the CCPA seems to be raising red flags. You know, there's the tech companies that are concerned, and you guys are at Tech Freedom, so maybe that's the bucket you're concerned about. There's app developers, which may fall into the tech company bucket. There is advertisers, and advertising, I think, is another issue of privacy law that is its whole separate challenge, whole different debates and arguments. And then there are these other people, like the brick-and-mortar retailers, which have not had to deal with this type of date law before, and always the example of the mom-and-pop deli and pizza place and laundromat. So are you concerned about all of those people? Is there a specific sector that you're concerned about?
So I think that the brick-and-mortar stores are a good place to start,
okay,
just because I don't think they speak the language of online commerce and these sorts of requirements in quite the same way as the tech companies or these other firms that have had to deal with these requirements before. I think that as we think about where the CCPA is going to go in terms of its enforcement and the broad definitions of personal information in some cases, such that it may include even your likeness, we may be in a Prop 65 scenario where you're going to have notices all over the place.
What's Prop 65 for our listeners?
So for our listeners in California, if you've ever been to a Starbucks, to one of their little milk stations, you're going to see a warning saying that this premises is known to have chemicals which can cause cancer and other problems. And so Prop 65 ensures that consumers are aware of that in their coffee and at Starbucks. There are things that are bad for them. Basically, it's a litigation hook, and that's what it's become. And so there's a concern among brick-and-mortar retailers that they are going to be subject to exactly those sorts of, I would say, unhelpful requirements that are sort of a drag on business and potentially litigation traps for them.
That's fair. I actually think that they're, you know, everybody who, if you've ever been to Europe, you'll no doubt know all about cookie banners and all of those sorts of notices they get in Europe. I think there's a very real concern that that might be a solution that companies deploy for the CCPA. While the CCPA says currently present that it gives you an ability to opt out of the sale of your information, there are exceptions to that. Consent for the certain direction of your information is an exception. So conceivably, you could actually get away from having this weird opt-out requirement by just putting up a bunch of notices right. on your website that we're all going to have to click through. Part of the issue, I think your point is, we haven't actually seen the Attorney General's guidance on this. Another, I think, real issue with the CCPA, to pivot randomly, is that it puts a lot of requirements on the Attorney General's office. You know, the CCPA 2.0 introduces the concept of a California Privacy Protection Agency, which I know it's more bureaucracy. But around the world, you've got these data protection agencies that actually provide guidance. You have experience in California, and certainly the California Attorney General has always been sort of policing tech. Kamala Harris did a lot of stuff. But I do sort of wonder if they're equipped to be this all-purpose tech regulator.
So I don't necessarily disagree with you that just having the Attorney General as the catch-all is not the best way to move forward as an enforcement sort of mechanism if you're going to pursue this type of legislation. However, as designed, this new agency, I think, is putting itself in a position to have to be probably more onerous than you might otherwise see. So, for instance, it's entirely funded by fines that it is going to collect from industry. And unlike the Department of Insurance, which puts fines into the general fund and then receives an allocation from the legislature, in this case, this agency is going to collect fines directly, support its operating costs, and then remit them to the legislature, minus 9% on top of that for consumer groups. So you can tell that it's trying to do something a little different, that it's very cause oriented, and there's no question that they will have a specialty that the Attorney General's office will not, but it's misaligning incentives for their own enforcement activities, I think.
Guys, let me because we're running a little bit short on time. Let me ask you to take a step back. An astute listener will have heard you talk about now extensively what's happening in California. You mentioned Washington. I heard Illinois discussed. There are several other states interested in doing something on the privacy front. At some point, it's good to have decentralized governance and let a thousand flowers bloom. But Joe, I think you would even agree that at some point this becomes a serious problem for just doing business, period, online, from not just a business perspective, but from a consumer perspective. So what happens next at the federal front if we're inundated with these wave of state laws? Or what do you want to have happen? I know the current legislative environment is challenged, shall we say, at the federal level, but it doesn't seem to me like this is either optimal or practical going forward. We certainly wouldn't have this approach in many other areas for internet policy on free speech issues or some others.
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, it's not ideal. I would say that, you know, industry groups will constantly say we have to avoid the dreaded patchwork. We're not at a patchwork yet. Right now, so far, aside from some of these lip laws like Illinois' biometric law and Vermont's data broker law, the only two states that have a comprehensive privacy law are California, and then Nevada did we'll call it a CCPA light. Those two laws are not in conflict. Frankly, I think you're likely to see a lot of states emulate the CCPA. Now, there will be wrinkles on that. Had the Washington Privacy Act passed, that would have added more requirements. New York State is interested in the idea of information fiduciaries, which goes a little bit over my head. And so you start having states pass that, then I completely agree with you that we have a real, real problem and Congress is going to have to act. So why hasn't Congress, why hasn't the federal government act? I don't know. I mean, I guess there's...
So from your perspective and then Ian from yours, what would be optimal once, again, we don't know what the tipping point is, probably two or three states know that's not a, you know, patchwork, 10 plus maybe?
No, I don't think you need 10. I think you really do need like three different approaches.
Okay,
so
right.
If you give me information fiduciaries, Washington State doing risk assessments and CCPA 2.0, the federal government has to intervene.
So is there a measure out there right now that you find attractive or that you think provides a solution to that from your perspective?
That's been proposed at the federal level?
Yeah.
I mean, there are a couple that are behind closed doors. So if you've been following the federal privacy debate, there has been a lot of, I think, good faith work on both sides of the aisle. It's just a complicated issue. We're not talking about the federal, how Congress works, but I think there was a lot of hope that, the Senate and the House Commerce Committees could handle this. But then you've got the Banking Committee wants its you know,
sure.
bit of this.
It's a turf war. Yeah.
Yes. And right. so as a result, the issues that they're dealing with have ballooned and gotten larger and larger. And then, to be totally honest, and this just reflects maybe where the administration's priorities are, the Trump administration hasn't really gotten involved or put
right.
its thumb on. We all, last year, the NTIA, which was an acronym, National Telecommunications National. And Information Administration.
Correct.
Woo. They solicited comments from organizations. I think everybody, companies, trade associations, individuals, academics filed comments. I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds of comments. And that was almost a year ago, and it's been radio silence. Mm-hmm. That's a problem.
So, Ian, is there anything in the form of just straightforward, clean preemption of the field that would just say you can't do this, states, without a lot of heavy-handed regulatory baggage? Or will any federal measure come with a new overarching sort of regulatory approach that would concern you? Is there any happy middle ground?
So I'm not entirely sure that there is on the legislative side. I think potentially there is a role for states to play more on the enforcement side, and there certainly is a role for states to play in sector-specific privacy regulation. So I think for industries that are traditionally regulated at the state level and that have existing bodies of privacy law, it probably makes sense for them to continue in that vein so as not to disrupt the entire industry. But this is something where the federal government needs to step in, needs to clear the field. This is something where the FTC needs to be given clear guidance on what exactly they should be doing, what they should be enforcing, and then also making sure that their enforcement powers are well-targeted, well-refined, such that you're not seeing companies out of left field being subject to vague requests and being subject to fines without a keen understanding of exactly what their violation was.
And Joe, Ian mentioned the FTC. We haven't talked a lot about the Federal Trade Commission here today, but if we'd have had this discussion just a couple years ago, it would have been front and center because the Federal Trade Commission, especially in the Obama years, was quite active on the privacy front. There was a whole host of workshops and reports.
It's continued to be pretty active if you look at the headlines.
Well, and now we've moved to fines and things like that, and consent decrees are gearing up. We've had those all along, but is that the backstop? Is that what we should just expect going forward now at the federal level for the next couple of years until we get enough states conflicting and then we preempt?
Well, I mean, absolutely. The Federal Trade Commission sees an area for it to be engaged and active in. There's headlines to be made, and they've developed deep expertise. They also have, frankly, international obligations. They're the primary enforcer of the Privacy Shield, which deals with transatlantic data flows. They want to be viewed, and for a long time were viewed as the top global privacy enforcer. There's no reason to suggest that their appetite for that has diminished. Now, we will definitely disagree and quibble over whether they have the adequate resources. I mean, in consumer privacy land, the Federal Trade Commission is this behemoth. But in terms of actual federal regulatory agencies, it's a really tiny outfit without a whole lot of people. And that's a real problem.
Let me ask you both closing question here, which is, in our previous FedSoc podcast on these issues, we talked with Hal Singer and Jeff Manny about antitrust and the tech lash. And a lot of the conversation there and a lot of the conversations in general about antitrust are starting to incorporate a privacy component. This has become very controversial for a variety of reasons. Privacy has never really been part of the purview of antitrust law, but now it's becoming part of it, or at least people are pushing it to. Is this a trend that we should expect to continue? Should it be part of antitrust review? Will that be the primary way at the federal level we see privacy addressed, is through antitrust law?
I am not a competition expert, but I do think it's weird. I think it's sort of inevitable. I mean, there are interesting cases in Europe where you have European competition authorities relying on the GDPR to require certain things of Facebook. The reality is everybody has acknowledged that data is a valuable resource. I'm not going to say it.
Thank you.
But data is a valuable resource. That data has there are vested interests in that information. Some of those vested interests are still my interest as an individual, and that's the privacy conversation. And then, of course, though data is valuable to companies because it's allowing them to develop new products and to innovate. And so, you know, that gets into the universe of competition. So I think they are two separate conversations, but we're sort of stuck in an environment where they've been intertwined, and I don't know how we untangle that now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a good way to move forward. I think the many interests in any given, you know, bit of data are such that it's really challenging to apply antitrust sort of principles in the context of a firm's relationship to any given body of data.
Well, that's about all we have time for in today's show. But before we close, I'm going to let each of our expert guests today tell you first two things about themselves, where to find them on social media, and second of all, what's the most recent thing you've written on this that you would like our listeners to take a look at, and where can they find it? Ian, you first.
So you can find me on Twitter at IA the Teapot. This goes back to an appearance on cable news where I apparently my spout overfloweth. But in terms of what I've written on this topic in particular, I would say for purposes of understanding what we're facing in California, this would be a piece that is unrelated to privacy in particular, but rather the structure of initiatives in California. And this is called The Troublesome Legacy of Prop 103. And what you have is a proposition that was passed in 1988 that has not been meaningfully changed since then. And you've seen the complete stagnation of an entire industry as a result of that. The new version of CCPA that is being contemplated has a similar provision, what's called an in furtherance clause, which prevents amendments that do not, quote, further the purposes of the initiative. So it's been a real problem in insurance. It'll be a real problem in California in privacy.
And on the California ballot effort and what's been going on up there, you just had a blog post yesterday.
I did indeed.
It's on the Tech Liberation Front, among other places.
I hear that's a good blog.
I think it's a great one.
Home field advantage, you guys.
Joe, where can people find you on social media, and what's something you've written recently they should read?
So I'm also on Twitter at Joe Jerome. So at Joe Jerome. I'm putting out a piece, hopefully in the near future, knock on wood, with the IAPP, that's the International Association of Privacy Professionals, that looks at the question of private rights of action and privacy laws. We didn't touch on that in this conversation, but once you get past the preemption debate, private rights of action tend to be the second, third rail of privacy debates. And my position is that the basically industry saying this is a non-starter and advocacy groups saying we need to have an expansive, unlimited private right of action is not terribly nuanced and not constructive to the debate that Congress needs to be having.
Okay, great. Thanks to both of you for joining us here today. And I want to ask our audience to make sure that you subscribe to the Fourth Branch podcast on whatever podcasting platform you enjoy using. Until next time, see you later.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.